This presentation is on advancing an anarchist theory for women's human rights activism. And before I start, I just want to give a little bit of background about myself and why I became interested in the topic. I've been interested in human rights theory for the past few years, and I've recently been sort of a volunteer with Amnesty International, which is one of the largest human rights organizations in the world. And so I've been very active in the women's human rights movement in different capacities. And this presentation sort of grows out of my disillusionment with a lot of the approaches taken toward advancing women's human rights, specifically with Amnesty International, as well as others in the mainstream human rights discourse. And so basically, I want to do three things. First, I want to talk about some of the connections I see between human rights and anarchist theory, and some of the real conflict between those two. And then also trying to advance a theory that brings the best of both traditions together. There's just a couple clarifications to make. The first thing is, why do I distinguish between human rights and women's human rights? It seems that those two shouldn't be mutually exclusive in any way. But in fact, if you look at the history of human rights discourse, what you find is that it's deeply gendered. The mainstream human rights discourse looks at primarily governmental violations of individual, civil, and political rights, and this occurs primarily in the public sphere. And so these have been traditionally human rights violations that impact men. Whereas if you look at the human rights violations that women face, they're primarily private individuals. And the human rights discourse does not recognize private individuals in international human rights law. And so what essentially you find is that violence committed in the public sphere, that is by an agent of the state, has traditionally been considered the locus of human rights violations, whereas violence committed in private spheres, that is by a family member or friend, which primarily affects women, has not been considered a human rights violation in the international human rights regime. And so you have this real dichotomy between what is a human rights violation for men and what is one for women, and why isn't the human rights discourse addressing violations of women's human rights? And so in order to rectify this gender bias of international human rights law, feminist human rights lawyers drafted a human rights convention called the CEDAW Convention, and it stands for the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And it was ratified by the UN in 1979, and so that shows that, you know, the UDHR was ratified in 1944, 45, I think. And it really wasn't until 1979 that, you know, people were saying, well, wait a minute, what about women's human rights? And basically, the CEDAW Convention affirms both positive and negative state obligations to advance women's human rights. So negative obligations dictate what states should refrain from doing. And then positive obligations are defining what measures states should take to advancing human rights. So if you look at the CEDAW Treaty, it does things like say, it says what states shouldn't be doing. And it says things like states should repeal discriminatory laws and practices. And so those would all be negative state obligations. But it also obligates states to create the conditions in which women's human rights can be actualized. That would be sort of a positive state obligation. And so what you find in the mainstream human rights discourse is activists generally agree that, yes, like a legalistic framework is very good and necessary to advance women's human rights. And so people are advocating for reforms like criminalizing domestic violence and penal codes, allocating funding for domestic violence shelters, and working for socialized medicine for women and mothers. So in the sort of mainstream discourse, the state is constructed as both an impediment to advancing human rights, but also as the protector of human rights to a certain degree. And this is very problematic because a question is not being asked, and the question is, can the state act to protect human rights? Specifically, can it act to protect women's human rights in the context of my discussion here? And so, you know, it's my convention that as human rights activists, we shouldn't seek to increase state power to protect human rights. Instead, we should work to dismantle the social and economic structures that are permitting human rights abuses to occur. And the way that you do that, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, is to sort of replace these structures with decentralized, community-based, and non-hierarchical forms of social organization that are actively seeking to promote human welfare. So basically, what is this framework? It seems like very abstract, and I want to sort of give a little example about the benefits and drawbacks of the human rights framework in advancing women's economic human rights. So if you look at a case like economic human rights, you're generally looking at the incidence of poverty. And so, you know, as we know, in the world over, women and children comprise the majority of impoverished people. And so what organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, human rights lawyers, what they generally do is they look at state policies in looking at economic human rights violations, and they ask questions like, well, does the state affirm women's right to work? Do they have laws stipulating equal pay for equal work? Are employment policies advancing women's economic human rights? And that's all well and good, but it does have very serious limitations, because what's happening is that if you rely on a discourse in which the state is a protector of human rights, you're accepting the legitimacy of the state system. And you're basically saying that, you know, the capitalist economic system is essentially just, and we just need to, you know, sort of usher women in by making various laws and policies. And if we just give people the resources, you know, to get on board, you know, we can really advance women's economic human rights. And of course we know that that's not really the case. So I guess what I'm sort of proposing is a new framework for women's human rights activism. And I'm looking at sort of three ways we can bridge human rights theory with anarchist theory. And there's three ways I think we can do this. And there's probably more, but this is all I have at this moment in time and for this short presentation while we're here. The first sort of bridge that you can sort of link these theories is the fact that international human rights law prioritizes human rights above the claims of sovereign nation states. And that's a really important point, because it allows for activists to look at state complicity in human rights violations. And I'll go into that a little bit later. The second point is that if we develop a human rights education that is consistent with anarchist principles, I think we can make this sort of connection between the two theories. And that's a fairly simplistic point, but again, I'll go into that in a moment. And the third point is a bit more complicated, but it has to do with the normative paradigm of international human rights theory. And basically, that has to do with the fact that when you look at things like a criminal justice system versus a restorative justice system, a criminal justice system is inherently focused on a punitive aspect, right? Like crime and punishment. You know, if you do the time crime, you got to do the time or whatever. And that's not really how international human rights law works. It's rather it's saying that this is a normative framework, and it's proscribing the way that human beings should act, how we should behave. And so if we look at this framework, we can see that I think this fits in very nicely with anarchist conceptions of justice and relying on more of a restorative justice approach to advance human rights rather than a criminal justice framework. So now that I've sort of given you a taste of the three links between, I want to go back and talk about each one of them in a little bit more depth. So the first one is looking at state complicity in human rights violations. And as I said, since its inception, international human rights law has valued the claims of individual rights above the claims of the state. And I think that this is a very fruitful avenue for anarchist theory, because it does provide this sort of secular and internationally affirmed framework for undermining the legitimacy of the state system. And it also allows for human rights activists to focus on how the state is oftentimes complicit in human rights violations. So when we look at state complicity, we're basically saying that if a state is complicit in a human rights violation, it means that they're essentially they can be implicated in the infraction. And I know that this is sort of a difficult concept, but basically, in complicity, you can't establish a direct causal link to the state. Like, you can't say, like, because of this state law or because of this state policy, this human rights abuse occurred. Of course, you can do that in some cases. But what you can also say is that the state is complicit because the violation occurred in the first place. If the state was committed to advocating and advancing everyone's human rights, we wouldn't have these egregious violations in the first place. And so, in the case of women's human rights, the real prevalence of discriminatory or oftentimes violent acts by private individuals wouldn't occur in an environment committed to women's human rights. So, although in international human rights law, the state is never implicated in cases of domestic violence, right? States are basically saying, we did nothing for this violence to be occurring. It's not our fault. This is private individuals, right? But that becomes a way to absolve the state from taking responsibility for the acts of violence that are occurring. So even though the state is not a direct causal agent in domestic violence, it's fair to make the case that the state is complicit in these human rights violations because it's perpetuating the customs, values, and institutions that are allowing these human rights abuses to occur in the first place. Does that make sense? Is that point?
Yeah, certainly.
Okay. I think that that's a very good way for anarchists to come in to the human rights discourse, and it really undermines the legitimacy of states in that way. And we can talk a bit about this when I finish. I just wanted to go through a few more ideas. A second point is human rights education. And I think that we oftentimes undervalue the importance of human rights education, but it really is a very transformative avenue for social change. At present, however, in the United States context, which is the only one I'm familiar with, so I can't really speak. I'm familiar with the Canadian context a bit, but I can only speak from my experience, but our human rights education is very, very poor in this country, and I think oftentimes what you find is that, you know, people say, oh, well, human rights is just the golden rule, or it's just religious education that children are already getting. And really, that's not really accurate. It doesn't allow people to claim their rights when you say that, oh, it's just common sense, you know, everyone has human rights, everyone should be respected. When you look at cases like poverty, for instance, there's a real difference between saying someone is poor and between saying someone's economic human rights have been violated, right? Because in the first case, generally in the United States, you know, it's your fault if you're poor, you didn't work hard enough, etc. But for someone to say, you know, I learned that I have economic human rights in school, and you know, my economic human rights are being violated, that really shifts the blame from the individual, and it really allows people to have the potential to claim their rights. And so another aspect of human rights education, specifically in the United States context, is the problem of imperialism. Oftentimes we think that, oh, you know, human rights are great for, you know, people in the third world, but we don't really need them here. We don't have human rights violations here. And so that's something that really needs to be rectified if we're going to have a consistent human rights education. And the third aspect that could be problematic in human rights education in the United States is relying too narrowly on UN human rights conventions and looking at the committees and the treaties and you know, has this been ratified, has it not been ratified? And I think that obscures a lot of what we're really trying to get at, which is, you know, what are human rights and how do we build cultures of respect for them, which is the most important part. And then the final aspect of human rights education I wanted to touch on briefly is that most human rights advocates, educators, activists are not anarchists. They're deeply invested in and affiliated with things like NGOs. A lot of them are lawyers. You know, they're heavily invested in the state system, and so you have to look at a way in which you can advance human rights activism and human rights education with people that are not necessarily coming from the same political background as you, and that can be a real challenge. So I just wanted to touch briefly on using the normative framework of human rights and what that means. And basically it means, you know, what I said earlier, just building cultures of respect for human rights. And this really can't arise from a criminal justice framework that is looking at punishing or bringing justice to offenders. And we find this discourse a lot in the case of violence against women, specifically in the United States, but also increasingly in an international context. And what you find is that, you know, when violence against women occurs, we want to go directly to the source, like who's the perpetrator of this and how can we punish them? And I don't think that that's necessarily effective because if you look at things like the Violence Against Women Act in the United States, for instance, it really uses this criminal justice framework for, you know, addressing the incidence of violence against women. Well, okay, that's great, but how is that preventative at all? And criminal justice can't really prevent crime from happening. It can only punish it after the fact. And that's not really what we're focused on in human rights discourse. I just want to end with sort of an anecdote that I think draws many of these theoretical complexities I've been sort of discussing into focus. And that is the case of Mukhtarin Bibi. She's a Pakistani woman who was raped in 2002 by a village council. She was gang raped to punish her brother for an alleged sexual infraction. And so, you know, what human rights activists were saying at the time was that, you know, the government of Pakistan is complicit in this violation of women's human rights because it allowed an extrajudicial system to subject this woman to this abuse. And so I think a really interesting theoretical problem is that, specifically for anarchists, is that, you know, a non-state judicial system, right, which is sort of what we favor, in this case was much more oppressive than any act. Not any act, but it was extremely oppressive. And so that's very problematic, and that's something that needs to be questioned and talked about and addressed. But getting back to the story, I'm like going off on a tangent. Anyway, a bunch of activists went out to protest the Pakistani government for allowing this to happen to this woman. And there was about 100 activists sort of gathered on the steps of the embassy of Pakistan. And, you know, people were crying out, you know, we need to bring justice to the perpetrators of this egregious, you know, human rights violation. And the whole time I'm thinking, like, well, what does justice mean in this context? And how would that work in advancing women's human rights? And so... I guess I just want to end with a series of questions, and I know it's sort of awkward, but I think oftentimes that asking the right questions is helping to facilitate the learning process more than me saying, like, I have a theory or whatever, because I don't, I have ideas. So some of the questions are, you know, is the criminal justice framework or the attempt to seek out and punish perpetrators effective in diminishing women's human rights violations? Does it provide a normative framework that affirms a population's disapproval of violence against women, or on the contrary, does the criminal justice framework merely perpetuate the societal structures of hierarchy and domination that are the underlying causes of such abuses? Okay, so, and then that's one question. Then my last question is, does the practice of using state violence to incarcerate human rights violators truly address the reasons for their violence, or does it merely respond in kind, this time by using the violence of the state? And then, is it necessarily advantageous to remove human rights violators from the community, that is, people who are raping, for instance, or committing egregious acts? And how would that work in an anarchist framework? And so I've come to the conclusion that, you know, diminishing the state jurisdiction in human rights violations is important, but more important is dismantling patriarchy, right? We have to dismantle social structures, norms, and practices that perpetuate men's systemic advantage over women if we're ever going to have women's human rights protected at a community level. And so that's really all I had. I hope it wasn't confusing for people. I know it's awkward to just ask a bunch of questions, but yeah, I hope that that brings up thoughts and ideas. And so if people have, you know, anything that they'd like to share, I'd be interested.